Welcome to Midday here on WYPR. I'm Nathan Sterner, and today for Sheila Cast. On today's program, we're going to be looking at a few recent studies out of Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, the largest school of public health in the world. We'll be exploring three studies later this hour, one on how older adults manage the burdens of the healthcare system, another on teen drug use, and a third on the impact of firearm licensing laws on suicide and homicide rates. But first, a look at refugee resettlement. On Tuesday of this week, Governor Larry Hogan released the following statement on Syrian refugees seeking new homes in Maryland. Quote, "As governor of Maryland, the safety and security of Marylanders remains my first priority. Following the terrorist attacks on Paris just 4 days ago, and after careful consideration, I am now requesting that federal authorities cease any additional settlements of refugees from Syria in Maryland until the U.S. government can provide appropriate assurances that refugees from Syria pose no threat to public safety." Those were Governor Larry Hogan's words in a statement on Tuesday. Hogan is one of more than half of U.S. governors who have asked federal authorities to suspend resettlements until their concerns about the thoroughness of background checks are addressed. And the Republican-controlled House of Representatives have drafted a bill to block the settlement of Syrian and Iraqi refugees until Congress receives additional certification from national security agencies that they do not pose a security threat risk. The bill also adds additional layers of oversight to the program. In response, the White House has vowed to veto the bill if it's passed, stating that it would, quote, "introduce unnecessary and impractical requirements that would unacceptably hamper our efforts to assist some of the most vulnerable people in the world, many of whom are victims of terrorism." The White House statement also noted that of the 2,174 Syrian refugees admitted to the U.S. since September 11, 2001, not a single one has been arrested or deported on terrorism-related grounds. We're joined now for a look at refugee resettlement by the executive director of the International Rescue Committee in Baltimore, Ruben Chandrasekhar. Welcome back to Midday, Ruben.
Thank you, Nathan.
We heard the White House's statement that more than 2,000 Syrian refugees have been admitted to the U.S. since September 11th of 2001. About how many refugees from Syria have been resettled in Maryland in recent years?
Well, since the Syrian refugee crisis, actually since the civil war started in Syria 5 years ago, the U.S. has resettled, as you said, under 2,000 individuals across the country. And in Maryland, I believe that number stands at approximately 40 individuals. We've resettled three Syrian families in Baltimore in the last year.
What conditions are those refugees fleeing in Syria?
You know, on Friday, November 13th, the world caught a glimpse of what a terrorist group like ISIS is capable of doing. And it's important to understand that over 4 million Syrian refugees, you know, people who have fled their country, have been subjected to not just ISIS, but the Assad regime's terror tactics for the last 5 years. They've been living with this terror for that time. And the Syrian crisis is a conflict that has been characterized by the brutal and indiscriminated killing of civilians during that time. So these are the conditions that Syrian refugees are fleeing. You know, they're fleeing persecution and terror, and that's something that we have to recognize.
There's been a whole semantic debate in recent months about the difference between a migrant and a refugee. What specifically does the word refugee mean here?
Well, in the U.S. context, a refugee is somebody who's demonstrated a credible fear of persecution based on their race, religion, national, their involvement in a political group or based on a political opinion, and you have to prove this credible fear of persecution in order to be considered a refugee and be allowed into this country. And, you know, what most people, I think, don't recognize is what's happening with Syrian refugees crossing the Mediterranean and the Aegean Sea into Greece and then going to other parts of Europe is a far different procedure than what happens within the U.S. refugee resettlement system, which is a very orderly system that thoroughly vets every single applicant who applies for refugee status and entry into the U.S.
Explain that vetting process. It is a very thorough process, is it not?
It is. So, you know, one of the Syrian families that we resettled about a year ago fled Syria after, it's a mom and dad with five children, five girls, and, the day that their son was born, their sixth child, the hospital that he was born in was bombed and he was killed. And they, at that point, decided to leave Syria because, you know, if they felt if a hospital isn't safe, then what is? And they wanted to protect the lives of their children. And they fled to Lebanon. And there they decided to apply to enter the U.S. as refugees. And between 2012 and 2014, they went through a series of security screenings that involved in-person interviews, the collection of biometric data like fingerprints and so forth. And all of that was run through filters through the Department of Homeland Security, the FBI, the Department of Defense, and so on. And it essentially took them 2 years to clear these security screenings before they were offered the invitation to enter the U.S.
And 2 years, that's about typical for how long these screenings take.
I think that's an average right now for Syrians in particular. But, depending on what part of the world the refugee is coming from, it could go anywhere from, 18 months to 36 months.
So perhaps up to 3 years.
Yes.
The Obama administration has said that refugees face the most rigorous security screenings for anyone entering the U.S. On Marketplace, broadcast yesterday evening here on WIPR, it was reported that it is harder for refugees to enter the U.S. than folks entering the U.S. on travel or even educational visas. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. As I've described, every single refugee applicant who applies to enter the U.S. is thoroughly screened by various security agencies, and they have to prove that they have a credible fear of persecution, that they are being persecuted and not the ones doing the persecuting. And only after all of those screenings come back clean do they have the opportunity to enter this country.
Once the screenings do come back clean, how's it decided where refugees will be resettled in the U.S.?
One of the cornerstones of U.S. immigration policy is to reunite families. So if a refugee already has a family member residing in the U.S., then they would make that known in their application. And so they would say, I have a cousin in Baltimore, and I'd like to go there, in which case they would be routed to Baltimore City, and an agency like the IRC would welcome them and provide them with services to help them integrate locally, and become self-sufficient. If you don't have a family tie in the U.S., you may say, Syrians may say, hey, listen, there's a vibrant community in Dearborn, Michigan, for example. You know, even though I don't have any family members there, I'd like to go there because there are other Syrians who could help me. But if you have no choice, you would just say, I want to go to the U.S., and then the various resettlement agencies would essentially choose where to place you.
How many agencies are involved in resettlement efforts?
There are nine national resettlement agencies that resettle last year approximately 70,000 refugees. And this year, the president has raised that ceiling to 85,000, and that's how many we intend to resettle.
As I mentioned earlier in this program, more than half of U.S. governors have asked federal authorities to suspend resettlements from refugees from Syria, this following the terrorist attacks in Paris last week and the news that one of the people involved in those attacks may have entered Europe posing as a Syrian refugee. What was your reaction when you heard the governors asking federal authorities to stop sending refugees to their states?
Well, first, I'd like to say that the International Rescue Committee stands with the world in condemning the terrorist attacks on Paris. What happened there on Friday of last week, in Beirut on Thursday, and in far too many cities across the Middle East in recent months is horrific. And, there is never any justification for such indiscriminate slaughter and terror. Having said that, I do believe that the governors who've come up with this policy of preventing refugees from coming into this country have got it wrong. On the one hand, governors and state officials, they do not have the authority to prevent a refugee who has been lawfully admitted to the U.S. from residing in their state. Number two, if a refugee arrives, you can't preclude them from entering your state because we have freedom of movement in this country. And I fundamentally believe that attempts by state officials to limit the arrival of Syrian refugees to their states are grounded in misinformation about who Syrian refugees are. As I stated before, the over 4 million Syrian refugees who have fled their country are fleeing terror and fleeing a very despotic government that does not want to, open up that country to any kind of democratic reform. They are the ones who are being persecuted, not the ones doing the persecuting. The process that Syrians or other refugees use to get into Europe is what we have seen on the television of late, but it's a vastly different process than the U.S. refugee resettlement system, which has been operational, for over 40 years. We have a very sophisticated system. It's a well-oiled machine, and every single person who applies to enter the country as a refugee is thoroughly screened to ensure that they are the victims of persecution and not the other way around.
And let me step back. International rules require, really, that the U.S. accept refugees, don't they?
Yeah, so in 1951, the U.S. and other governments signed what is commonly known as the Refugee Convention. And what that convention states is that when people are forcibly displaced from their country because of persecution, based on their race, religion, etc., that this international agreement would allow for some of them to start a life in another country, so that they could have basic access to human rights like safety, food, clothing, and shelter. And that agreement today is in some ways being challenged because people are conflating, especially within this conversation around Syrian refugees, conflating Syrians with terrorism, and I think for us to conflate an entire population in this way is frankly un-American and unfair.
As you mentioned, legal precedents basically say the governors don't have any real authority to stop refugees from settling in their states, right?
That's right.
So what are these calls really for? Is it just symbolic? Is it playing into some sort of political narrative?
Well, that's that's hard for me to answer. I'd love to pose that question to Governor Hogan. What I would say is that I'd invite Governor Hogan to visit the International Rescue Committee's office and meet one of the Syrian families that we have resettled and listen to their story. And I think once he found out what kinds of conditions they were fleeing from, the conditions that they lived in Lebanon as refugees, and the type of life that they're leading here in Baltimore, I think if he heard all of that, I believe he would change his mind. I understand that Americans want to feel safe, and the U.S. refugee resettlement system is designed in such a way as to bring in, as I said before, people who have been persecuted and who have demonstrated that, and they're thoroughly vetted before coming here.
These refugee families, how are they reacting to the governor's across the nation's calls to stop refugees from coming into their states?
Well, it's interesting that you asked that. One of our Syrian families met with about 20 other people just two nights ago and had dinner with them just to share their experience and talked about how they'd lost their son when the hospital was bombed and how they had to flee their country, and how even before that, during the 4.5 years of the Civil War, they had witnessed so many atrocities in their neighborhood, neighbors being killed, people being beheaded, their two daughters afraid to go to school because they feared sexual and gender-based violence by militants, invading their neighborhoods. And, they were unequivocal in condemning, these terrorist attacks in Paris and just made a point to say that, that Syrian people should not be stereotyped as being one thing or another thing, based on what's happened in Paris, that it's unfair, and that they want nothing more than to have a safe place to raise their kids. And this is a family that was quite well-to-do. You know, the dad owned his own furniture business. They were actually quite well-to-do in Syria, but then lost everything. And I would just ask people who are listening, you know, to put ourselves in their shoes. You know, how would we feel if we had to flee our country, flee terror, flee for our lives with our children? And how would we want to be treated when we get to a place that we hope would provide some safety?
And you said the refugees you've spoken to want nothing more than a safe place to live their lives and to raise their children. Do these anti-refugee sentiments, we've heard calls from some lawmakers to remove refugees from their states, does this impinge on that safe place? Do they feel less safe in the U.S. now?
Well, I think that comparatively, you know, when you're fleeing a civil war, certainly Baltimore is a much safer place. But to the sentiment of this kind of xenophobic statements that are being, pushed out by both our public servants, but also some in the general public, it is hurtful. People who have worked hard all their life, but have faced tragic circumstances in their country and had to flee as a result, and who come here and they want to work and rebuild their life, they want to be given a fair chance to do that. And when they're stereotyped as being, you know, people who want to cause harm to this country, I think it hurts them. The counterexample to this sentiment is what, you know, Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake, you know, when she issued this statement a couple of days ago to say, you know, the Baltimore City welcomes immigrants and refugees, I think she recognizes, like many other mayors across the country, that immigrants and refugees can help rebuild the population and tax bases of cities. They can bring in a new energy. As I said, you know, just picture yourself if you had a chance to, you know, to find a safe place as a refugee, and you had a chance to get a job and to take care of your family, how motivated would you be to do that? That's what I see in doing the work of refugee resettlement, that refugees are incredibly resilient. Yes, they've gone through a traumatic experience, but they want to rebuild their lives, and they can be a huge asset for Baltimore City, because as they rebuild their lives, they're rebuilding the city.
Ruben Chandrasekhar is Executive Director of the International Rescue Committee in Baltimore. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Quick break now on Midday. When we come back, navigating the burdens of the healthcare system. Appointments, medications, tests. It's tricky for pretty much anyone. But how do older adults fare? We'll get some answers. We'll also take a look at trends in drug use among teenagers, with a look at how today's teen drug use rates compare to rates from a decade or two ago. And we'll be exploring how laws decriminalizing marijuana may be affecting teen drug use. All that is coming up when Midday continues here on WYPR. Stick around. Welcome back to Midday here on WYPR. I'm Nathan Sterner, in for Sheila Cast. Think about your experience navigating the healthcare system. If you've ever needed a second opinion or have had to go in for a round of tests, you know just how confusing and complicated the world of medicine can be. A new study based on data collected from a national survey found that 4 in 10 older adults feel burdened by the health system and find that managing their medical needs is difficult for them or for their family members. Here to discuss these findings is Jennifer Wolf, an associate professor of health policy and management at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Her research focuses on the delivery of care to older adults with complex health needs and on how to support older adults and family caregivers. Jennifer Wolf, welcome to Midday.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
As I mentioned, your research shows that 4 out of every 10 older adults are having trouble managing their medical needs. What sorts of troubles are they having?
So our study is not able to go into a lot of detail about the specific challenges that they face, but this is the first nationally representative survey to examine older adults' experiences with the health system and some of the difficulties that they and their family members have in terms of managing their health. We developed a supplemental module that was fielded to about 2,000 older adults who participated in a national survey.
When we say older adults,
65 years and older. And we were interested in understanding their preferences for making medical decisions with doctors and family and friends, as well as their experiences in managing their care. Most of the studies to date that have focused on understanding quality of care have focused on understanding quality for a particular condition or a given disease or delivered by a specific provider. And this sort of disease-by-disease focus on quality is problematic in thinking about care for individuals with complex health needs or multiple chronic conditions, because oftentimes they see many providers and as a result may experience difficulty understanding their conditions or being able to manage the care that's provided across by multiple providers.
So instead of looking at just providers or just conditions, we're looking at the entire older adult population, or at least a representative sample thereof.
Exactly. So we were interested in, first of all, understanding the experience of all older adults, but also understanding their experiences across all of the providers that they see in managing all of their conditions. So focusing on sort of the whole person approach instead of disease by disease or body part.
You mentioned deciding pathways of care, how they work with their caregivers and work with their family and friends. What did your findings show there?
So we were actually surprised. We found that about 7 in 10 older adults manage their health independently, and that about one-third or about 3 in 10 older adults either co-manage their health or delegate their healthcare activities to family or friends. And we found that 85% of older adults prefer to actively engage in decision-making with providers. And this is surprising because the prevailing evidence in the scientific literature has described older adults as being passive or disengaged in care.
As wanting to work more with others, but your findings show that they really want to work more with their physicians.
So we found that they expressed a preference for engaging actively with doctors as opposed to delegating decisions to doctors. And this was surprising because most studies have compared older adults to working age adults or focused on convenient samples of older adults with low health literacy or that are particularly sick. So our study was nationally representative and provides a more accurate understanding of older adults as a group and suggests that they're more actively involved in managing their health and prefer to be involved in managing their decisions with doctors.
Are there changes for people who are more sick or experiencing complex diseases, multiple diseases?
So we found that about 1 in 10 older adults report that they delegate managing their healthcare activities to family or close friends. So these 1 in 10 older adults were disproportionately old. They were less educated and they had a higher burden of chronic medical illness. About half of the older adults who delegated healthcare activities to family and close friends were suspected of having cognitive impairment, and they were twice as likely to be categorized in our study as having a treatment burden, what you described as reporting that managing their care was difficult for them or for their family or close friends, or that their activities and tests were delayed or didn't get done, or that were cumulatively too much for them to do.
So treatment burden, those two words appear a lot. The 4 in 10 that are having problems, that's what treatment burden is, that it's a burden to get this treatment, to manage their own treatments.
Right. And that reflects the idea that sort of, again, the disease-by-disease focus on quality may miss an important aspect in understanding individuals' experiences with care, and that it's important to understand all of what they're being asked to do.
The 6 in 10 not feeling significant treatment burden, what were their lives like?
Well, our study was not specifically focused, again, on understanding all of the experiences of individuals in navigating the health system. We did find again that individuals who are healthier and who are more independent in managing their care were less likely to experience treatment burden. I think in subsequent studies, we would want to understand better how we can reduce treatment burden by simplifying care. Our study suggests that there may be a role for patients and families to interact with providers and ask if there are ways to simplify their treatments, for example, by taking fewer medications or understanding what medications are most important for their particular goals and needs, or by taking medications less often.
That's quite a lot to do, though, that to figure out all of those different medication changes, different ways of dealing with different diseases. How do you tackle such a giant chunk of the healthcare industry?
Well, so this is a really important issue today in particular, because there's been a growing awareness and movement in healthcare delivery towards incentivizing high-value care.
What does that mean?
So that's exactly – so what does that mean is the right question, and that's part of what we were trying to understand, is by focusing on individuals' overall experiences. But high value care in the context of quality, and recognizing that we're trying to meet the needs of individuals, is care, I would say, that is reflects collaborative dialogue with providers, and it's really guided by individuals' priorities and goals of care. And recognizing that meeting these meeting the needs of individuals may benefit from having more time with providers to really have a dialogue about what matters to patients and to move towards meeting patients' goals.
Goals of care. How do we decide what goals of care are, or even what goals of care should be?
Right. So that involves a discussion and between patients and their providers, and really understanding the care that's being provided across not just a single provider or encounter, but across all of their providers, and understanding how the treatments that they've been prescribed relate to their goals. And oftentimes there may be a disconnect between the medically oriented definition of quality of care for a particular condition versus an individual's goals of improving function or being able to participate in daily activities.
And that comes back to better communication between the doctors and the patients, something that your studies have shown patients really like to have, closer coordination with doctors than perhaps had previously been thought.
Right. So I've been very particularly interested in understanding how to improve communication for older adults with complex health needs who navigate the health system with family members and friends. And there is the family member's role can be particularly influential in raising awareness of helping improve information exchange and providers' understanding of patients' conditions and treatments. Companions or family members can also prompt patients to be more involved in asking questions that within a very brief encounter, for example.
So instead of an either or, families and friends working with patients to help decide their healthcare goals, or doctors working with patients to do the same, it should be a collaborative effort of both of these groups.
Exactly.
What is it that's preventing doctors from taking some of the extra time with patients that that they need to make sure that they're clear on what needs to be done?
So the current payment system is very constrained and focused on a 15-minute visit, and many of the individuals who attend medical visits with a family member have multiple chronic conditions, and the focus oftentimes on the dealing with the conditions that are most acute and pressing take precedence over the discussions that may be also very important but not as likely to rise to the top. So I think the time, sort of the short fee-for-service 15-minute visit is a real problem. And I think another challenge is...
What can we do to change that, though? How do we change procedures and policies so that the 15-minute fee-for-service gets thrown out, and longer, more in-depth meetings to help determine care become the norm.
So this is really actually a very exciting time in healthcare because there is more of a focus on paying for value and moving away from fee-for-service 15-minute visits and allowing providers to innovate to deliver care in ways that are better equipped to meet patients' needs. And so as a result of moving away from 15-minute visits and allowing providers to construct visits, group visits, or interact with patients in other ways that are potentially better equipped to meet their needs, the system is there's a lot of experimentation going on now to try to do exactly that.
I'm not in the older Americans bracket yet, but I know that whenever I go to see the doctor, I always get a bit flustered and forget at least half of all of the questions that I mean to ask. Is there any way that we can ensure that people remember all the questions that they need to ask? Is there any sort of preparing or planning sort of a thing that could be done with patients and doctors so that stuff that needs to happen, needs to be discussed, doesn't get forgotten and left to a later visit or no visit at all?
Yeah, that's a great question. And in fact, that's in part what family members often do when they attend visits with older adults is prompt older adults to remember their questions or to ask or to raise issues that the doctor should be aware of. So writing down questions and I think also consumer health information technology and the ability to direct message with providers is another way that's that sort of raises the ability to make sure that questions are not asked.
What can caregivers learn from this study if they are heavily involved in their family members or friends' care? Are there takeaways that folks who are not older Americans but help their relatives or friends, are there things that they can think about as they help their patients?
That's a great
or is that a question for a further study?
I think so.
Jennifer Wolf is an associate professor of health policy and management at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Thank you so much for telling us about your work, Jennifer.
Oh, you're welcome. It's been great to be here.
And we are going to take another short break here on Midday here on WYPR. When we get back, another health study on drug use by teens. I'm Nathan Sterner. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Nathan Sterner, in today for Sheila Cast. This hour, we've been taking a look at some new research out of the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins University. We now turn to another study on drug use by teens. In recent years, more than a dozen states have decriminalized the possession of small amounts of marijuana. Some have legalized medical marijuana, and two, plus the District of Columbia, have made marijuana legal for recreational use. But what has that meant for the levels of drug use by teenagers? Has the loosening of laws on pot caused an increase of use? Maybe not, at least according to research conducted by Renee Johnson, an assistant professor in the Department of Mental Health at the Bloomberg School. Her work focuses on the health of adolescents and emerging adults, with an emphasis on substance use and on violence. She's also deputy director of the school's Drug Dependence Epidemiology Training Program. Renee Johnson, welcome to Midday.
Thanks so much for having me.
And your research found that teen marijuana use is actually down over the last 10 years, despite greater availability. How did you gather this data?
Well, I really appreciate your starting with the policy. So since 1999, we've had lots of states pass laws on medical marijuana, pass laws on legalization, pass laws on decriminalization. But if you ask people what is happening, most people will say drug use among adolescents is increasing and increasing and increasing.
That's the public perception.
That's the public perception, and it's not true.
Drug
use goes up and drug use goes down, and it's not always increasing. So what I thought I would like to do was infuse some epidemiology into this discussion and think about what are the actual trends in use of marijuana and other substances, particularly given all of the loosening of restrictions.
So we'll get to the other substances in a moment, but let's focus on marijuana to start. What were rates like in 1999? What were rates like back at the beginning of the study? What's your baseline? What are you comparing?
Okay. So we're starting in 1999, and what I found was that lifetime marijuana use among U.S. high school students has decreased over the past 15 years, from 47% in 1999 to 41% in 2013. Now, importantly, it was at its lowest in 2009, and that was about 37%. So it's increased a bit since 2009.
Is it an actual trend, or is that just a fluctuation of...
Yeah, we don't know. So there's our statistics tell us that we can't rule out that that is just a random fluctuation. So we're going to have to continue to study this and see if it continues to go up. We don't know if it's a reversal in the trend, the downward trend, or random fluctuation.
So it's possible that rates are on the rise from 2009, but compared to 1999, rates of marijuana use in high schoolers are significantly lower.
Significantly lower, from 47% to 41%.
Your research has also shown that there is a gender gap in marijuana use in high schoolers. Tell us about that.
So over time, the gender gap has gotten smaller and smaller. In 2013, the gender gap is fewer than 3 percentage points.
What did the gender gap used to be?
Oh, it was more like 7 to 10 in 1999. I'm sorry, I can't remember specifically. But, you know, historically, boys have had higher rates of marijuana use and girls have had lower, and we're seeing that disappear. And part of the reason is that boys and girls, it's like gender equity, which is great, but also increases girls' substance use. So boys and girls are in friendship groups more than they used to be. It used to be more boys smoke marijuana together and then go out with girls. But now it's boys and girls smoke marijuana together as a friendship group. And this has implications for treatment, because a lot of our treatment centers and systems are geared around men. So we need to consider
that. And so now that genders are using marijuana at not exactly the same, but very similar rates.
Yeah.
That changes the way that that we as a society will work to prevent that use.
Exactly.
You've also seen some changing trends in marijuana use when broken down by race.
Yeah, I was really interested in race differences and race by sex differences. And what we found, so it declined across the board for all racial groups. And we looked at race by sex groups. What we found was that the decline among blacks was less severe than among whites. So as a result, blacks now have a higher prevalence of marijuana use compared to whites, whereas historically, whites have always had a higher prevalence of marijuana use. And much of that is because of the decreasing gender gap among black girls and boys.
Hmm. Is there a change in perception of risk? Do kids today think that marijuana is more or less risky than they did back in 1999?
Yes. So what we have found is that perceptions, and the question is, how harmful do you think it is to use marijuana once or twice? And then how harmful do you think it is to use marijuana regularly? So the how harmful do you think it is to use marijuana once or twice, I think about 36% of U.S. Adolescents say, yes, very harmful. And then it's more like it's closer, it's higher when you talk about using it regularly. So the perceptions of risk are going down compared to earlier years. I would argue that I think that that is not as terrible as we think it is, because when you look at heroin, like perceptions of harm for heroin, perceptions of harm for marijuana, perceptions of harm for cocaine, young people are really ranking the drugs in a way that a researcher would rank them as well in terms of how harmful they are. So I don't think this is kids not thinking marijuana is harmful, but rather them having a really clear assessment that some drugs are really terrible. As a researcher, adolescents to rank heroin as more harmful than marijuana. Although I want them to see that marijuana absolutely does have harms, but I would argue that this is young people educating themselves rather than something to be worried about.
And I guess it's also fascinating that young people think marijuana is less harmful now, but they're using it at a lower rate than when they thought it was more harmful. Am I extrapolating those numbers correctly?
Yeah. So
what
I
would
have
be behind that.
So the linking of perceptions of harm and use are separating, and everybody in the field is wondering, like, what is happening with this? I just think young people are better informed, and I think we don't give young people credit. I think an adolescent can recognize that marijuana, if you use it one or two times, probably won't kill you,
but they're still going to make a decision not to use it.
We don't give them credit. People just think, if it's there, adolescents will use it. And I think adolescents have a lot going on and are able to make decisions and able to make smart decisions. And I think that may be what's happening.
Now, how do you get the data that's used for all these analyses? Are kids really going to give you accurate portrayals of what they think and of what they've done if you're asking about risky behavior that they perceive as risky behavior?
So in my experience, adults, teachers, and parents worry a lot more about survey questions than young people do. That it's not difficult for young people to answer questions about sex, about drugs. Like, these are conversations they're having. I think we worry, oh, these delicate kids, how will they answer a question about marijuana? And they're fine with it. They don't even think twice. And, you know, you also have to think the young people of today are just so used to tests. They're like always filling out things. So to answer your initial question, these data come from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Youth Risk Behavioral Survey. This system was started in 1990, and it provides nationally representative data about adolescent risk behaviors, including sex, drug use, smoking, exercise, obesity, eating disorders, a little bit about mental health. So much of what we know about youth risk behaviors comes from this particular surveillance system. And just to give it a plug, it's federally funded and publicly available, so any of your listeners could find out more about it. So researchers have lots of ways to understand whether people are reporting accurately. And one thing that we know is that this is a school-based survey, and young people are more likely to report honestly in the school than they are when it's at home.
Okay, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
You don't, if you're going to lie, you're going to lie when your parents are there versus when the teacher is there.
Yeah, and when there's a survey, usually the teacher steps out and a research administrator comes in. And then there are also instructions that say this is entirely confidential and, you know, they're fine with it.
So these studies don't just look at marijuana use, also other drug use, alcohol, cigarettes, et cetera. What sort of trends are we seeing there?
So since 1999, everything is down. And this was important because I wanted to see, is marijuana changing and everything else is staying the same or going down or going up? And what we see is that everything is going down. So alcohol has gone down from mid-80s percent in 1999 to 66% in 2013. Cigarette smoking has really, really gone down from, I think, about 75%, and this is lifetime use, so have you ever used in your life, from about 70% to 41%.
That's a big change.
It's a big change, and it really represents a lot of work in the public health arena around changing norms around smoking. So actually, adolescents, the prevalence of use of marijuana is now higher than cigarette smoking. I mean, just a couple percentage points, but that's the trend.
And that's something no one would have suspected would have happened back in 1999.
Yeah, or certainly not back in 1992 when I went to high school and they had the smoking section for kids, which sounds crazy now. And so then we also looked at hallucinogens, ecstasy. So marijuana is the most commonly used illicit drug. Lifetime prevalence of use is about 41%. And then the prevalence of use of other illicit drugs drops a great deal after that. So hallucinogens, about 9%. Ecstasy, about 8%. Cocaine is about 6%.
Woo! 6, not 60.
And meth was another, like, it kind of was a flash in the pan, and it had a
a big heyday, and then now it's just down. I think we really got the word out, like, that it's
terrible.
Which is good. So that's about 3%. Heroin also is 3%. I mean, and really, like, 2.4%.
And so the most commonly used substance is alcohol.
The most commonly used substance is alcohol.
At least at this point.
Two-thirds of high school students report lifetime use of alcohol.
Is there any single thing that you can think of that's driving down drug use, alcohol use, cigarette use? Or is it just a combination of a great many factors and a greater awareness of the world around the by teens?
I think it is a combination of a lot of factors. And I will say that it is easier to understand and track why we're seeing changes in legal drugs versus illicit drugs. So with alcohol and tobacco, we can see the public health interventions and the policy changes, and then really kind of do analyses to see how much things decreased after a certain period of time. But with illicit drugs, we can't use those same methods. There's not a new regulation that comes out and then we track it. I think also part of it was that for marijuana specifically, in the late 80s, marijuana use was pretty low. This was Reagan, the Anti-Drug Abuse Acts, the crack epidemic, and criminal sanctions for illicit drugs were quite serious. After the crack epidemic, they moved from addressing crack and cocaine to addressing marijuana. So for a couple years, marijuana use was kind of low and then and hard to access. This is my theory. And then by 1999, it increased a little bit. So and then it decreased from that. So I guess this is to say that illicit drug use goes up and down. The highest time was the late 70s, when I think 50% of young people were reporting past month drug use. And then it decreased. So it just goes up and down anywhere between 10 and 20% over time.
But at this point, we're down. We mentioned earlier, many people think that teen drug use is becoming more common. Are you hoping that your research will correct that misperception?
I am hoping that, and I am hoping that in all of these discussions, what we do is see adolescents as people who are able to make decisions. So 80% of high school seniors say they could get marijuana if they wanted to. Nowhere near 80% of high school seniors uses marijuana on a regular basis. So what that tells me is that young people already have access to marijuana and choose not to use it. And let's think about that as these laws change and talk to young people instead of just pretending that if we legalize marijuana, everybody's going to rush to use it. I think we need to respect adolescents a little bit more.
We end our show on respect, then. Renee Johnson, assistant professor in the Department of Mental Health at the Bloomberg School, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you. It was great to talk to you.
And thanks, everyone, for listening. And thanks to Eddie's of Roland Park for supplying lunch for our guest today. Eddie's is a full-service market with locations on North Charles Street and on Roland Avenue in Roland Park. Their deli features unique sandwiches and salads with specials each day. All of that listed on their website, eddiesofrolandpark.com. Be sure to join us tomorrow on Midday for a conversation on vacant properties in Baltimore, how the city's vacants-to-value program is measuring up to claims of success, and how neighborhoods are fighting against neglected properties. We'll get some answers about the Vacants to Value program tomorrow on Midday from noon to 1. I'm Nathan Sterner, in today for Sheila Cast. Thank you so much for joining us. Have a great afternoon.